The Science Inside Podcast. This is the Science Inside.
Hello and welcome to the show doing the most with regards to reporting news and the most current events around science, tech, and innovation. I'm your host, Bridget LeBerry, and we have a very interesting topic this evening, and I'm sure it will excite you as much as it has excited me. It's been challenging because there's a lot to go through, but tonight we unpack a really interesting topic, as I've mentioned, on turning Wi-Fi signals into electricity. And in a report published recently by Moody's Investors, South Africa's electricity grid still suffers tremendous pressure to perform and give power to numerous households and to businesses. And the reserve margin is expected to remain tight until at least the mid 2020, and Moody expects South Africa to still remain dependent on Eskom for power supply. So today, as I've mentioned, we will be discussing a very innovative and alternative way of generating electricity, which is Wi-Fi signals being turned into energy. And as you know, electromagnetic waves are all around us, and they come in various forms, from gamma rays, from radio waves, microwaves, infrared, which is visible light, X-rays, and all of that. And we've seen how these can be exploited to generate electricity when we talk about solar energy, which draws energy from the sun. And now you can imagine if we were going to explore this topic of using Wi-Fi signals as another form of providing energy. And I feel it's anything is possible, really. I mean, if you think about it, who would have thought we'd be talking about a topic such as this one's? And scientists believe that this could add numerous benefits to the field and the world in general, not to mention South Africa. And we know that there are people who have ventured into this kind of technology. And I know of a young businessman who's gone into doing this. He actually created a bag. This bag actually converts the Wi-Fi signals to charge all electronic devices, from his laptop to his phone to his MP3 player, or maybe if we say his iPod. When it is inside the bag, he knows for sure that it is being charged. But for more on this, we will talk to, actually we've spoken to a professor from the Witwatersrand University, Professor Mervin Naidu, and he explores with us and tells us how this can be made possible, and how and why actually it took so long, because this technology is not really new. I mean, it's been around for a couple of years, and they've been talking about it, and then they've been experimenting. But this young man, he went a step further into, you know, actually looking into exploiting using Wi-Fi signals to actually charge. But we do know that Wi-Fi signals are not strong enough, like the current electric current that we have, that can actually produce the kind of, or the amount of electricity that we actually need. But later on in Unscience, we look at a study from the University of Bern that has discovered how humans can actually unconsciously retrieve vocabulary from an entirely new language during particular phases of slow wave sleep. But as always, we kick it off with the science news.
This week's science headline.
Good evening. As per usual, I have my co-host here with me, Masibulele Lunika. So what do we have in the news tonight?
In your news-making headlines, Harvard scientist claims to reverse aging. Scientists find plastic chemicals in high Arctic birds, and proposed artificial leaf design could save the environment. This is Masibulele Lunika here with the Science Insight News. David Sinclair, a renowned Harvard University geneticist, recently made a startling assertion that scientific data shows that he has knocked more than two decades off his biological age of 49 years. What's his secret? He says his daily regime includes ingesting a molecule from his own research, which was found to improve the health and lengthen the lifespan of mice. Sinclair now boasts online that he has the lung capacity, cholesterol, and blood pressure of a young adult, the heart rate of an athlete. Despite his enthusiasm, published scientific research has not yet demonstrated that the molecule works in humans as it does in mice. Sinclair, however, has a considerable financial stake in his claims, proven correct, and has lent his scientific prowess to commercializing possible life extension products such as molecules known as NAD boosters. NAD stands for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, a key compound in all living creatures. His financial interests include being listed as an investor on the patent license to Elysium Health, a supplement company that sells an NAD booster in pills for $60 a bottle. He's also an investor in Inside Tracker, the company that he says measured his age. According to NBC, discerning hype from reality in the longevity field has become tougher than ever as reputable scientists such as Sinclair, preeminent institutions like Harvard, align themselves with promising but unproven interventions and at times promote and profit from them. Fueling the excitement, investors pour billions of dollars into the field, even though as many of the products already on the market face fewer regulations and therefore a lower threshold of proof.
And researchers have proposed a design solution that could bring artificial leaves out of the lab and into the environment. Their improved leaf, which could use carbon dioxide, which is a potent greenhouse gas from the air, would be at least 10 times more efficient than natural leaves at converting carbon dioxide to fuel. These artificial leaves mimic photosynthesis, a process whereby plants use water, energy from the sun, and carbon dioxide to produce food for the plant. But even state-of-the-art artificial leaves, which hold the promise in reducing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, only work in the laboratory because they use pure pressurized carbon dioxide from the tanks. However, researchers from the University of Illinois in Chicago have proposed a solution that could bring artificial leaves out of the lab and into our environment. The improved leaf would be at least 10 times more efficient than natural leaves at converting carbon dioxide to fuel. And their findings are reported in the journal ACS, Sustainable Chemistry and Engineering. And a assistant professor of chemical engineering at the UIC College Engineering and corresponding author, Minesh Singhon, said in order to implement this successfully in the real world, these devices need to be able to draw carbon dioxide from much more dilute sources such as air and flue gas, which is the gas given off by coal-burning power plants. But unhooking the pressurized carbon dioxide supply would mean that they must have a way to collect and concentrate carbon dioxide from the air to drive their artificial photosynthetic reactions. Singh and his colleagues Aditya Prajapati, a graduate student in his lab, proposed solving this problem by encapsulating a traditional artificial leaf inside a transparent capsule made of semi-permeable membrane of quaternary ammonium resin, and it was filled with water. And what this membrane actually does is it allows water from the inside to evaporate out when it is warmed up by sunlight. As the water passes through this membrane, it selectively pulls in carbon dioxide from the air. The artificial photosynthetic unit inside the capsule is made up of a light absorber coated with catalysts that convert the carbon dioxide to carbon monoxide, which can be siphoned off and used as a basis for the creation of various synthetic fuels. Oxygen also is produced and can either be collected or released into the surrounding environment. And according to their calculations, 360 leaves, each which are about 1.7 meters long and 0.2 meters wide, could produce close to half a ton of carbon dioxide per day. And that could be used as a basis for synthetic fuels. 360 of these artificial leaves covering a 500 meter square area would be able to reduce carbon dioxide levels by 10% in surrounding air within 100 meters of the array in just one day.
Scientists have warned about the impact of plastic pollution in the most pristine corners of the world after discovering chemical additives in bird eggs in the high Arctic. Eggs laid by northern fulmars on Prince Leopold Island in the Canadian Arctic tested positive for hormone-disrupting phthalates, a family of chemicals that are added to plastics to keep them flexible. It is the first time that additives have been found in Arctic birds' eggs. The contaminants are thought to have leached from plastic debris that the birds ingested while hunting for fish, squid, and shrimp in the Lancaster Sound at the entrance of the Northwest Passage. The birds spent most of their lives feeding at sea, returning to their nest only to breed. Northern fulmars have an oily fluid in their stomachs, which they projectile vomit at invaders that threaten their nests. Scientists believe that the phthalates found their way into the fluid and found their passage into the bloodstream and the eggs that females were producing. Jennifer Provencher at the Canadian Wildlife Service said it was worrying to find the additives in the eggs of birds in such a pristine environments. Provencher's tests revealed that mothers passed on the cocktail of contaminants to their unborn chicks. She analyzed the yolk and albumen of five northern fulmar eggs collected on Prince Leopold Island and found that one tested positive for phthalates. We know that the cause for concern that phthalates disrupt the endocrine system, and this may cause birth defects, fertility issues, and a number of metabolic diseases. Scientists now want to look for plastic contaminants in the eggs of other bird populations that ingest more plastic debris. Recapping your top stories this hour, David Sinclair, a renowned Harvard scientist, university geneticist rather, recently made a startling assertion that scientific data shows that he has knocked more than two decades off his biological age of 49 years old. Scientists have warned about the impact of plastic pollution rather in the most pristine corners of the world after discovering chemicals additives in bird eggs in the high Arctic.
And, well, Masibulele, I know we generally go through our stories, but it seems like, you know, time is not on our side and we have to get into our interesting story for the week, which you have covered, and we have a package on your side.
Yes.
Let's get into it.
This is the Science Inside.
Welcome back to the Science Inside. And if you were with us earlier on, you might have heard that we are talking about a new or a really interesting research study that has been looking into turning Wi-Fi signals into actual power. So to follow on this conversation, and if you want to tweet or you want to ask some questions, obviously our social media handles on Facebook, it's VowFM, and you can also tweet us at VowFM, Hashtag Science Insight. The podcast is up on iTunes and the vits.journalism.co.za/science. And our WhatsApp line is 084-078-4912. And as I have mentioned, Masibulele Lunika did a story on how Wi-Fi signals were turned into energy, and we get into that package.
MIT scientists invent a Wi-Fi to electricity converting device. Imagine a world where you no longer need to connect your electronic devices directly into a power source or use batteries in order to charge them. Instead, your electronics pick up radio frequencies in the atmosphere and convert them into electricity that powers them. This is exactly what a device that has been invented by scientists and researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology enables, or does. The researchers have described this as the first fully flexible device that is able to convert energy from Wi-Fi signals into electricity that could power electronics. The device works by converting alternating current into direct current using a flexible radio frequency antenna that captures electromagnetic waves, including those carrying Wi-Fi, as AC wavefronts. In science, devices that convert AC electromagnetic waves into DC electricity are known as rectennas. MIT says the device, which is made from flexible, inexpensive materials, could power large area electronics, wearables, medical devices, and more. According to the research, the antenna is connected to a novel device that is made out of a two-dimensional semiconductor just a few atoms thick. The AC signal travels into the semiconductor, which converts it into a DC voltage that could be used to power electronic circuits or recharge batteries. For more on this story and this technology, we spoke to Professor Mervyn Naidu from the School of Physics at the University of the Witwatersrand, who said this is highly possible given that we already harness energy and electromagnetic waves from the sun to generate electricity.
So you can use the energy of the sun to generate electricity.
Mm-hmm.
So why not use electromagnetic energy from any other source?
Okay.
And there's so much of it nowadays because everybody's using their mobile phones, everybody's using these antennas that transmit radio waves all the time for communication with mobile phones.
Mm-hmm.
So when a person transmits a radio wave to broadcast the voice of Wits, you're broadcasting an electromagnetic wave that travels through space, and if you have a receiver, it receives it in a special way. It converts that signal into a sound form.
And they speak about converting sort of an AC.
Exactly, all waves.
Mm.
When you think of a wave, electromagnetic, it's got an alternating form. It's just a signal, the way the signal arrives.
Yes.
Okay, so it's propagated in that way.
Yeah.
All right, so that's the way waves travel. Busy. It's just a matter of how you harvest it. It's a question of harvesting the energy.
Yeah.
It's a question of, there's all of this ambient radio waves in the environment, all around us, all of the time. And just why we haven't harvested this accesses that are there, because they're radio waves all of the time, it's possible the signal is not that strong all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on what the strength of the signal is and how well the material you have that can absorb the signal can convert it into some kind of power output, which can be used to drive whatever circuitry.
In terms of concerns regarding intense radio frequency exposure, which we know can be harmful to the body if absorbed in large quantities, Professor Naidu said this is not to worry about, as the effects of this could have already been seen since the energy being harnessed is already out there and around us.
Our radio waves have been around for such a long time. We've been communicating with them forever. And so the density of transmitters have increased over time. But invariably, if this was dangerous, we would have seen the effect by now. Because it's exponential in terms of the number of users that you have of people using cell phones or transmitters that have been put up to transport information.
But this whole time it's been regulated.
But ill-regulated in the sense that, of course, you can't have a powerful transmitter that can fry things.
Yes.
So that's not the way radio it's transmitted over a large sphere, as it were, and it spreads out like a sphere. So the energy density drops dramatically as you move further and further away from the transmitter. It actually drops over as 1/r² almost, I think, in most cases.
Yeah.
So if you're close to the source of the transmitter, the energy density is pretty high. But that is why transmitters are put up at high places far away from where people can possibly stand next to it, for that matter. The reason why you feel warm in the sun is because you feel the infrared radiation from the sun, which is electromagnetic waves.
Yes.
So when your body absorbs radio waves, you don't sense it like a heat. You sense it, you don't even sense it at all. You know, it's just, it's a thing. It's not the, if it was that harmful, it was, it's such long wavelengths. That's the whole thing about radio frequencies. They're very long wavelength radiation, electromagnetic waves, which means they don't carry a high energy to start with. But the long wavelengths, what we mean by that is that if they're absorbed into the body, their energy density is so small that they can't really cause a grievous damage to the cells of the body.
According to the professor, this brings new and exciting possibilities in science, although the amount of energy drawn at the moment can only power small-scale electronic devices rather than entire households.
You need large surface area materials to be able to do this, okay? The power efficiency, which changes the signal it receives into an electrical signal, you know, not that efficient at the present time. But so you understand it doesn't take all of the energy and convert it into electricity for that matter. So there's an efficiency question that comes in, and I don't know if they're at the point where the efficiency is of a nature where they can say, oh, it'll actually become a power bank of the future. I don't know if that's the case. We're still struggling to get solar power up to that level where we can harvest solar power in a way that it's so efficient that we don't have to derive our energy from fossil fuels. I'm not saying it can't get there, but sure, let's see what happens. You know, time will tell as we improve the technologies and that kind of thing. So I can see things like that taking place, but whether or not it'll completely supply our energy needs, because we are such an energy hungry society.
This scientific innovation has been on the lips of a number of scientists at this point, and it has only now become a reality. We are still waiting for it to be presented commercially, and as we've heard from Professor Naidu, we were just waiting for the right enough material and the right enough technology to be able to harness it, and hopefully we have finally found it. The research, published by Nature.com last month, is titled Two-Dimensional Materials Enabled Flexible Rectenna for Wi-Fi Band Wireless Energy Harvesting, and was worked on by 15 co-authors from MIT, the Technical University of Madrid, the Army Research Laboratory, Charles III University of Madrid, Boston University, and the University of Southern California. According to MIT, the team is now planning to build more complex systems and improve efficiency. It's Masibulele Luniga here with the Science Inside News.
You're listening to the Science Inside, bringing you science around major news events.
Welcome back. I hope that was interesting enough for you. But as per usual, now we get into the nerdy part of the show. The part of the show that sort of relaxes us, that is, you know, where we get adventurous and nerdy and we look at the strangest side and the interesting side of research, really. And we find out what are the other wonderful and weird things that scientists spend a lot of their money and time and effort on. And today's Unscience was produced by myself, and the music is from Orange Sounds, and my Unscience story comes from Science Daily. Let's get into it.
Unusual, unlikely, Unscience.
Doesn't that remind you of your childhood, Masibulele?
No, doesn't that cute?
Yeah, but what if I were to tell you that you could learn an entirely new language? Which one would it be if you could choose
if I
one?
Could. Ah, tough question. I'd say either Spanish or French.
Well, the usual response yeah. from a lot of people. Yeah, but what if I told you that scientists from the University of Bern have proven that during particular phases of slow wave sleep, humans can actually unconsciously retrieve vocabulary from an entirely new language upon waking up.
Wow, that sounds so cool. Like something I could definitely make use of. But how is that even possible, Bridget?
Well, so far, sleep research has only focused on consolidating memories which had been formed prior to consciousness. But apparently, learning during sleep has never been explored because sleep has always been considered as an unproductive exercise, rather, well, at least for the body, but clearly not for the mind. Researchers have found that during the reviewing of replays of a sleeping brain, they found that replay during sleep actually strengthens the very delicate memory traces by embedding the newly gathered information in previously stored knowledge tanks of the brain.
Wow. So are you saying that his play sort of encourages the brain to remember the things we had said, heard, learned, bringing it back to the fore again so that it seems like a not-so-distant memory?
Precisely the point, and that is why the brain is such a phenomenal and remarkable network.
Wow, so how did they go about carrying out this research?
Well, Katharina Henke, Mark Zust, and Simon Ruch of the Institute of Psychology and the Interfaculty Research Corporation of the Swiss University, who are studying the decoding of sleep, went a step further. They wanted to find out if newly learned information during sleep could be remembered upon waking up by carrying out an experiment on participants. And they found out that these participants could reactivate the associations made with sleep-played foreign words to access parts of their brain for meaning of those words. And the part of the brain structure which is essential for wake associative learning, called the hippocampus, supported the retrieval of sleep-formed associations.
Truly remarkable. This could even perhaps explain theories like such as déjà vu, for instance, don't you think?
I'm sure they wouldn't rule that out completely, because Katharina discovered that during two crucial phases of sleep, during the up state, which is the active stage of the brain, and the down stage, during inactivity, between these two phases, the brain alternates in between every half a second, and that when words of an artificial language was played three or four times during the up state, the person was able to associate the German translated words and artificial language played words upon waking up, whether the sleep played words were dominated by something large or small. And Zust, who is the co-author to this paper, says the interesting part in all of this is that brain structures usually help with formation of new vocabulary learning during the conscious state.
Wow. Well, I guess this could dramatically change the lives of those who might have suffered during a traumatic experience, which may have caused them memory loss.
Absolutely, yeah. And this disproves the preconceived truths about sleep. When you're in a sleep state, you are detached from the physical environment. I mean, just like you mentioned, perhaps one's memory can be jogged up to remember basic information about themselves. And who knows, we might even be able to teach children in their sleep as well. And in fact, Katharina says the new research topic for upcoming years will be how far and what the consequences of deep sleep can be utilized for the acquisition of new information. And this research study was a joint effort between the University of Bern and Roland Waist, who is affiliated with the Support Center for Advanced Neuroimaging Scan at the Institute. So isn't that amazing?
That is just amazing.
It is
just incredible.
I just really love sciences around the brain and how it operates and, you know, what the brain can actually do. And yes. What do they say about the brain? We only use about 90%?
About 30%.
Yeah, 30%. But about 30%. And
actually less than
no,
that.
No, it's 10%.
Actually 10.
Yes.
You should get the, yeah.
Use 10% and the 90% is actually unexplored.
Mm-hmm. And I heard just 1% extra could achieve incredible things. I saw a movie once that was just so incredible. I forgot the name. It's a pity, but it's incredible how much the brain is powerful and what capacities it can reach.
Yeah.
If we just tapped on those untapped percentages, that's just incredible.
Yeah, truly beautiful.
Truly beautiful.
Yeah. Well, that was unusual, unlikely, unscience.
Unusual, unlikely, unscience.
Welcome back, and this is the Science Inside, and I'm your host, Bridget Lepere. And if you just joined us, earlier on we spoke about how Wi-Fi signals can be turned into energy, but we also learned that, I mean, these signals are not really strong enough to actually be converted to actually power up an entire house. But we have started, I mean, with small things like, you know, small devices like our cell phones, our laptops and other things. And I'm sure, surely our scientists will figure a way of generating enough power from these Wi-Fi signals to produce the power that we need to power up our households. But we continue with this topic, and we are going to talk about a slightly different science within the science of Wi-Fi. And we are going to be talking about how the CSIR has developed a range of wet and sonar transducers and arrays for specialized underwater applications. The team has established a small volume manufacturing capability that ensures that full configuration management is performed and manufacturing procedures can be tested and finalized prior to the technology transfer. Now, you may be wondering what this is all about, but the application of this technology can actually be used to support the fleet of operations of naval and commercial industries. Their shipping vessels can benefit from three-dimensional imaging with detailed information on features encountered underwater. Now, the electroacoustic underwater test facility at the CSIR is such a facility, and it is tasked with testing of underwater sonar transmitters, receivers, and arrays in respect of their acoustic sensitivity and acoustic beam patterns and electrical properties. And we learn how these technologies and how underwater communication has improved over the years, and what kind of improvements the team has done to the current systems, and how we can learn from their experience and from this research that they have carried out. And earlier on, I spoke to such a person who is a telecommunications engineer at the CSIR, Dr. Kahesh Denise. He specializes in underwater communications at the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research. And in the following clip, he takes us through what the aim of improving the current underwater communication systems is.
Our real aim is, right now in underwater world, people are getting voice across, but voice doesn't require a lot of data, or it doesn't require a very large bandwidth to actually get a voice across an environment. So what we're actually looking at is, let's start with picture, and if we get picture right, let's move to video next. So the actual application for this is currently right now with the underwater vehicles. They actually attach to the ship by a bit of an umbilical cord. So basically, like, you'd have your camera would take an image, and that image would be sent via this umbilical cord to a ship. And you can imagine, think of it as a wired phone. A wired phone, you lack that maneuverability. So that's the first way of actually communicating video currently. The second way is they send, like, a underwater vehicle. It goes and takes pictures of the whole environment. It then comes back and docks with the mothership. Then only does it actually give that information across. So those are the two traditional approaches that are currently being used in the underwater environment. But would it not be nice to actually have an underwater vehicle that's actually doing its thing and let's call it wirelessly sending that picture back to the mothership so that the vehicle can maneuver wherever it needs to maneuver, and it can send things in a real-time nature back to the mothership. So that's the application of this sort of work.
Here he tells us about the current challenges that face underwater communications and how this transducer will improve the amount of data that is being transferred per second, per minute.
The thing about underwater communication is there's this thing called a transducer. A transducer is something you put an electrical signal out and outputs a sound wave. Now, the problem with underwater communication has been that those transducers have actually been a very low bandwidth. If you have a lot of bandwidth, it means you can actually put out a lot more information. So now the problem that has been holding the underwater communication world back is they've actually had very low bandwidth, that means low throughput transducers, which they haven't been able to work with. So what we've done at CSIRO is we've developed a very unique high bandwidth transducer, and it's the first of its kind in the world. So right now, that's the competitive advantage we actually have over everyone else.
But now, problems with traditional terrestrial communication that has been used is that it offers limited mobility, as he has alluded to earlier on. And due to these wires that transmit the sound from the antennas to the device and to the communication network.
The best way to think of it is back in the old days when we still had the telephone, you understand? You needed to be close to your telephone to communicate with somebody. Nowadays, with cell phones, you can be anywhere and you can still communicate with another person. So the underwater world right now is still in the so-called telephone phase. Just try to make the transition from the telephone phase to the wireless phase.
So you may be wondering, how does this communication system really work deep down under the ocean and under the water? And in the following, he just paints a clear picture of how the system would work in simple terms.
I'm going to give a very simple analogy, right? So we have these big swimming pools and we put in antennas, or what we call them as transducers. So we put in into these big swimming pools an antenna on one end and we put an antenna on the other end. And we transmit from the one end to the other end. When we transmit, in our case, we're sending pictures. So we take a picture. The picture we're currently using now is of a jellyfish, because we thought it was appropriate. And we transmit that picture from one end of the swimming pool to the other end. And we get the picture on the other end, and we're able to do all sorts of things, like actually calculate how many errors are there in the picture. So that's just a simple explanation of how the whole system working.
Now, wireless communications is also not without its own challenges, because wireless communications can sometimes face high path loss due to increased density in the water. I mean, the sound waves, they need to pass through so many things. I mean, in the water, there's rocks, there's sometimes the waters are murky, and sometimes it's affected by also the weather and so many other elements because the environment is so harsh. And there are other things, I mean, like dynamic channel condition or large antenna size. And here he explains.
So basically, the higher the frequency of communication, the smaller the antenna size. So that's just a rough relationship between the two. That's why they try to communicate at a very high frequency, like cell phones and stuff. The reason they try to communicate at a very high frequency is you have a smaller antenna size. I mean, the lower the frequency, the bigger antenna you kind of need. Like this radio, it operates at a so-called lower frequency. You need like a reasonably big antenna. Like on your car, you need a car antenna to actually pick up this radio. Or if you're listening to it on your phone, you get those little earphones and you plug your earphones into your phone. Those earphones actually act as an antenna. So generally, the lower the frequency, the larger the antenna. And generally, the higher the frequency, the smaller the antenna.
Now you would wonder what would happen once the vessel is deep in the seas and away from the communication networks. Now, how does it pick up a signal? Does it use a satellite? What does it use to communicate back the sound if that proverbial umbilical cord is no longer there? In the following, he elaborates on this.
We need jobs in the country. And I mean, these sort of things, in my opinion, will actually start creating jobs. And it will actually create more collaboration with people abroad. Jobs will benefit the economy and the country going forward. I'm just very excited that we've been able to produce these large band transducers. first of its kind, then yeah, it can only lead to positive economic development.
However, with all modern technologies, we need to be aware of environmental and health hazards that come with the kind of technology that we use. And we need to be aware that, I mean, even though there's 3G and 4G technology, these things, they might even have some harmful effects on the environment and the people that are using these kind of technologies. And we hear more from Kahesh.
We need jobs in the country. And I mean, these sort of things, in my opinion, will actually start creating jobs. And it will actually create more collaboration with people abroad. Jobs will benefit the economy and the country going forward. I'm just very excited that we've been able to produce this large band transducers, first of its kind. And yeah, it can only lead to positive economic development.
I think this is really an interesting research that the CSIR has undertaken, because, I mean, with this kind of communications that happen, they are able to, you know, pick up whatever is happening below the waters. They can actually communicate if there are dangers below the seas, and they're able to, you know, give vital information that defense forces like the maritime actually need. So, Masivulele, what has piqued your interest from these stories that
interesting stories indeed. I find it so amazing that and in spite of all these problems that we currently face with power and electricity, we still have so much untapped avenues that we can explore in order to get more power. So to think of how much we have around us in the form of radio frequencies, electromagnetic waves and so on, and that we can actually just sit, and while I'm sitting here, my phone is being charged, or my computer, or my other electronics. So that is just incredible that we can even do such things. And when you look at the safety parts of it, I read on my iPhone not long ago about radio frequency radiation that could potentially be harmful if emitted in large quantities. But of course, as Professor Naidu said earlier, these things are not that harmful, because if they had been harmful, we would have seen the consequences by now. So that's quite interesting to me. It's just a matter of the technology that hasn't been found, you know, the right enough tools and resources that haven't been there to actually harness these this technology that's out there, this power that's out there. So now, as we're moving towards this future, this fourth industrial revolution, and as you mentioned, we have 4G and 3G, now they're exploring 5G.
Yes.
These things should be in existence already. It doesn't make sense why they haven't been.
Yeah, but during my interview with Kahesh as well, he mentioned that just as a precautionary measure on his side, what he actually does is, because I asked him, I mean, have we tested these things? I mean, mm-hmm. We just take these technologies, we take them to the ocean, we put them out there, and but before we actually carry out these studies, do we actually know the effects? And, you mm-hmm. know, he said they don't really know what's actually out there, because...
Yeah.
He actually said to me, if you ask any scientist if these things have been measured and if they have been tested, they haven't been tested on a large scale. I mean, and they haven't been tested over a long period of time, right?
Yes.
So obviously we wouldn't have the results that show that this is what they do. But he says, as a precautionary measure, he doesn't prefer speaking on his cell phone for an extended period of time, because when you do speak on your phone, there's the infrared and all these energies that come from your phone that get transmitted into your body. And you can imagine, I mean, for people who spend large amounts of time over the phone, these things
effect. I think it's the same. It's the same effect that I guess we have when exposed to too much sunlight, and we get these ultraviolet rays that can cause cancer, skin cancer, and things like that. So there's a common saying that too much of anything isn't good.
Sure.
So I think we need to keep in mind that we can't be too extreme about it.
Sure.
But it is definitely, in my opinion, an avenue to explore. And I mean, the regulative part of it needs to be checked also very closely, because if the law is not keeping a cap on these things, we stand a chance to be exploited by scientists claiming unbacked up stuff.
Claims. Research claims.
Exactly.
Yeah, so, and insinuations.
Mm.
All right. Then we'll just take a break, and then we'll come back with more after the break.
This is the Science Inside.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Bridget Lebera, and this is The Science Inside. And we have uncovered really interesting things today. I mean, as we were speaking earlier on about turning Wi-Fi signals.
Wi-Fi signals into electricity, my God.
Yeah, I never thought we'd be speaking about... it seems like Wi-Fi was just a thing that was just, you know, from yesterday.
From yesterday, exactly. Yeah. And I guess that's why it's so interesting in a lot of people's ears, is that, of course, we speak about solar energy, and we speak about, you know, other radio frequencies, electromagnetic energies that are around there. But Wi-Fi, no, I don't think anyone could have ever guessed that Wi-Fi could potentially be turned into power. I was personally shocked, and I found that out. And even earlier before that, I was just in the office borrowing a charger from a colleague, and then he said, wouldn't it be cool if I could just send you power, just like an SMS type of thing? I said, actually, yeah, I mean, that would be an interesting thing. And I saw this and I said, goodness, this is actually quite amazing.
Sure.
Wow. And then again, in cases where there's load shedding, it just sparked now. Would Wi-Fi be out there? Do you think it would work?
Possibly. Yeah.
Yeah, of course, if you're running it on battery power, for instance, and then maybe... you have your what do you call it, a Wi-Fi router that is powered by battery power. You could use that energy, I guess, to charge your phone.
Yeah, but what would be the point, really? I mean, like...
you're draining this one just to
get power from the other one, and then, like, it doesn't really make too much of sense. But yeah.
Maybe when you're in an emergency and you just need to just call someone fast.
It could work.
Yeah, for just a few moments, but yeah, definitely not not a solid power source. Yeah.
Yeah. But thank you so much for being with us on tonight's show. It's been intriguing. It's been really interesting. It's been really informative. And I would just like to thank our guests who were featured on the show, including Mervyn Naidu, Kahesh Denise, and obviously today the team behind the scenes, Masibulele Lunika and Tech by Kutwano Sirame. And our podcast, you can get it on vits.journalism.co.za/science and on iTunes and our social media pages on Facebook and Twitter. We are at Vow FM. The Science Inside is produced by the Wits Radio Academy and funded in part by the South African Department of Science and Technology. And that was it from our news desk and the Science Inside for this show. We will catch up with you next time. Next week, Monday, same time, same place on Vow FM.
Have a good night, everyone.
The Science Inside, Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. on Vow FM 88.1. The Science Inside Podcast.